From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A week after threats of violence drove Bolivia's President Evo Morales to seek sanctuary in Mexico, Bolivians converged again on the capital, La Paz, to demand the restoration of the government. For more on that, we speak with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua. We spoke with him via Skype on Monday. So it ain't over yet in Bolivia, for sure, and of course, people are in the street all across the region, so I don't know how you want to approach this. We can maybe start with Bolivia if you'd like, or we could start, you know, back Arbenz or, I don't know, Columbus, wherever you want to start. Yes. This has been going on long time.
I think you're right, Don. It's take your pick where you want to start. Where did this start?
Right.
And kind of, because what we're seeing in Bolivia, I know, as we were saying in an earlier conversation, is the way that the symbols of Christianity are now being used yet again to subjugate and attack and denigrate and destroy indigenous peoples in South America.
That's what the conquistadors did, like in, you know, the 1500s.
Yeah, I know. It was straight back to the 1500s, the 17th century, you know, the Inquisition, and the response to that is not any. We'll have to see what happens in Bolivia. And Evo Morales has said that he's very afraid that a civil war might break out,
right?
Precisely for the reason that that is now history, and it's literally history that can't be repeated.
Right.
And the indigenous people in South America, in indigenous people in across Latin America and the Caribbean, Afro-descendant people, and lower income people across the region, the impoverished majority, they know that they can have a better life, because people like Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro and Daniel Ortega and Rafael Correa and Evo Morales in Bolivia and Néstor and Cristina Kirchner in Argentina have shown that the majority in Latin America and the Caribbean that decent life is possible.
That's right.
And they don't have to spend their lives down in the dirt where the reactionary, tiny, usually white elites want them to stay.
Right.
Where do you start? Do you start back with Columbus? I do it. Do you go back to 1954 and Arbenz? That was.
You got all these different, you know, factors, right? If you go back 500 years, then you come forward, you know, a little bit. Suddenly, the Pope is dividing up, you know, the lands that belong to the people in the Western Hemisphere, and you have the impacts of that today. You know, hundreds of millions of people speak Portuguese in Brazil and Spanish elsewhere because the Pope drew a line back in the 1500s or whatever.
Right.
And now, though, you have a Pope who was born in Buenos Aires. Has anything materially changed? This is a good example of identity politics, by the way. Has anything really changed because of that fact? I guess we're going to see, but you know, this is still, you know, a power centered in Europe, representing the colonial imperial wealth of Europe, lorded over the peasantry in Latin America. But he was born in Buenos Aires, I guess, so it's all okay.
and now the Europeans were kicked out in the 19th century, and the United States took over.
Right.
But with exactly the same patterns of repression and domination that the old colonial elites used to apply.
Well, let's be accurate, too. By the United States, you mean the Europeans that are in the land now called the United States. It's not the indigenous people that were here that have stepped into that role in South America, but rather the Europeans who were here operating from here instead of from Europe.
Yeah, sure. And they're kind of Quisling collaborators, people like Condoleezza Rice and
or whatever, Barack Obama, etc.
Barack Obama, right. So And you're absolutely right. And the reason I think it's worth looking at that is because people tend to take much too short a view about events here, and so they start talking about pink tides and conservative right. restorations and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But there's actually a 500-year process of people in Latin America and the Caribbean struggling for their emancipation, and in many cases, more and more frequently over the last 100 years or so, achieving a measure of emancipation, a measure of liberation. And they, in 1954, the United States overthrew the Guatemalan President Arbenz,
right.
Jacobo Arbenz. And that was within 5 years. That was followed by the Cuban Revolution. And then they tried to squash that, as you said earlier. They murdered Che Guevara in 1967, hoping that by eliminating that symbol of a revolutionary change, it would do them some good. And obviously, it didn't. Then they had to overthrow Salvador Allende. And they had to institute the dictatorships in Uruguay and Argentina and Bolivia back then. And all that didn't do them any good. The Sandinista Revolution took place in 1979.
Right.
They tried to crush that. That didn't do them any good. All they did was, in Venezuela, their IMF structural adjustment programs produced Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez in 1998 took office as the Venezuelan president, and so on and so on. And then all from the election of Hugo Chavez to now, you had progressive governments, a flurry of progressive governments in historical terms, in Bolivia, Nicaragua again, the Cuban Revolution, a permanent symbol of hope.
Right.
For the region's impoverished majority, the progressive governments under Hugo Chavez and now Nicolas Maduro, the
right.
progressive governments in Argentina of Néstor Kirchner and his wife Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, now after a period of 4 years of a disastrous right-wing neoliberal government in Argentina, you now have a new a kind of progressive government with Alberto Fernandez, with Cristina as his vice president.
Right.
So, in Bolivia, they had 14 years of progressive government that completely changed the country under Evo Morales and Alvaro Garcia Linera. In Ecuador, you had Rafael Correa for a decade that completely transformed that country. So, and when you look at this coup in Bolivia, what it seems to me that what you're looking at is a sign of sheer desperation in terms of the an attempt by the right-wing elite in the region to put a stop to the progressive change that they detest so much.
Right.
And in Bolivia, it's taken an extremely hate-filled reaction on the part of a very clearly white middle-class minority who refused to accept the legitimate election result there. And I think that's very much an expression of a region-wide phenomenon. The right wing don't have a clue about what to do.
Right.
So all they have no political vision. They have no viable political program that will meet the national interests of their countries. It only meets the interests of themselves as a tiny elite in the region. And what that means is that, and I think we started talking about this in our last conversation, what that means is that because they're incapable of engaging successfully in democratic elections, they've now had to resort to successive coups in one shape or form, in some shape or form, from in Brazil, and they did so, and in Paraguay they did so, deposing Fernando Lugo back in, I think it was 2012. In Honduras, they a very similar coup to the one that we've just seen in Bolivia in 2009, deposed Manuel Zelaya. And going back to 2004 even, they had to depose Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti. And now in Haiti, you have a very similar situation to what's occurring in Chile and Ecuador with the popular protests in those countries. So, perhaps we should shift and start looking at the nitty-gritty of what's going on inside Bolivia. And I think it's important to put what's happening in Bolivia in that overall context.
I agree.
In a way, it's absolutely depressing and thoroughly depressing what's going on in Bolivia. But in another sense, it has all the symptoms of an acknowledgement by the right wing of their complete failure in political terms in the region. They're so desperate that they now have to carry out military coups in order to get what they want.
You know, one of the problems, I think, in communicating this effectively to people in the United States in particular, is that people here tend to think, because very little changes from administration to administration here. You know, regardless of the wild rhetoric, you know, that goes with the partisan name calling and you know, they bandy about the terms fascist and whatever at each other over things that, you know, really don't have anything to do with the term, in an environment that's saturated with fascism, by the way. But it's kind of like the water that fish don't notice, you know. So there's such a rage that goes with the essentially team identification that goes on, the red shirts or the blue shirts or, you know, shirts and skins, whatever, that people don't really have an understanding of what these political differences mean materially in places where there's an actual difference in the lives of people, whether this government is in power or that government. When you talk about someone like Evo Morales and the movement towards socialism taking power 14 years ago or whatever, and something like 30 to 40% of the population being lifted out of abject poverty or poverty in Bolivia, which to any American would mean the same thing, lifted out of that inside of a decade and a couple of years, and then being confronted with the possibility of going back to the condition that prevailed for perhaps 400 years before that. Those people are attached to the current situation and attached to their improvement in life much more strongly than someone who's worried about what's going to be said on MSNBC or Fox tonight. That matters a lot more to them. And at some level, they're going to be a lot more reluctant to let go of it, and they're going to fight a lot harder to keep it. And I don't think people get that here in the United States, that when we're talking about when the left comes to power in a place like Brazil, where suddenly people that have been completely powerless for generations, you know, their uncles and parents and cousins disappeared by military juntas and killed in the streets and such, having power to affect change, to have the economy moved in their direction, in places like Venezuela, where they build millions of apartment buildings inside of a decade that lift about a quarter of the population out of homelessness and shantyism into modern apartments. People remember these things. This is in their memory only a short period of time ago, that their lives, you know, were terrible, and they were improved by these leftist politicians that are not theoreticians to them, but people that worked with their community to deliver.
Yeah, and in Bolivia, you're talking about an indigenous population that was totally discriminated against, and comparable to the very worst kinds of discrimination that Afro-descendant people suffered in the United States over the previous 150, 200 years.
Yeah. You saw the tweet the acting president made a tweet a couple of years ago when she's a member of the parliament, this Añez. She was talking about how the cities are not for Indians.
Right. No, and very, very clearly racist. And they're absolutely open about it. They don't even try to hide it, because they think that's how things should be. Right. And it's like Nazis in the Ukraine or somewhere.
Yeah.
Or,
yes.
And going back to what you were saying about what people had and what they're now faced with not having it. And Evo Morales and his cabinet team, they nationalized Brazil's gas resources in particular. It's gas and not their hydrocarbon resources, but in particular importance, their gas resources. And with that money, they completely transformed the public services available to the whole population, not just the indigenous population, the whole population. And the Vice President, Álvaro García Linera, in a recent article called Hating the Indians, I mentioned some of the achievements of the government. And they, for example, back in 2006, 2007, when they took office, and Bolivia's GDP, and let's use that not very satisfactory measure, it was $9 billion. Well, now in 2018, it's $42 billion.
Wow.
That wealth that has been generated has been redistributed among the whole population. Now, what García Linera made clear in his promoting accessible healthcare, ensuring education for everybody, free education, access to a university for low-income people, in particular indigenous people, a prioritization of the social movements and the agenda of the social movements, despite widespread criticism of Evo Morales and his team from that self-same sector of the social movements. And in general, the reason that they're able to have an impact on government policy is because Evo Morales made that possible for them,
right?
And so, and from it's a kind of genuine democratization in race terms, in economic terms, in social terms in general. And what García Linera made clear in his article is that for the middle class minority, especially the white middle class minority, what that meant for them is that they no longer had a free ride. They no longer enjoyed the huge advantages that they previously enjoyed. It's as if in the United States, every white person suddenly became black overnight,
right,
and had to compete on equal terms with the Afro-American population,
right?
Because there was no discrimination.
Well, we saw how if you even move slightly in that direction, they go bananas. When you had affirmative action, busing, things that were intended to try to start unpacking, 400 years of overt racism, including the period of slavery and Jim Crow, but white working people in particular went crazy. And part of it driven by the fact that, as comfortable as they were compared to black folks and other folks, that came here not from Europe, they're also living, they know they're living, and their history has been living, precarious condition. And so they know that this is not coming out of the rich guy's pocket. And right. So you have all these people that want to cut each other's throats for crumbs.
Yeah, the difference in Bolivia is that the indigenous population has always been the majority.
That's right, but the huge majority.
Yeah, a huge majority. So, and despite that fact, they were kept down in the dirt by the white minority.
Right.
White-skinned minority. They take great pride, and it's pathetic. They take great pride in having a distinguished Spanish-sounding name,
Right.
Whereas people with indigenous names are regarded as kind of some obviously inferior. And it's pathetic. But Evo Morales and his government changed all that. And that explains the viciousness and the sheer hatred that has been apparent in this coup. And there's so many things to say about this coup. And one important thing to say is that even the right wing admit that Evo Morales won the election, right? Even the people that called for him to resign admitted that he won the election on October the 20th. What they're arguing about is by how much did he win, okay?
Right, that's right.
And because Bolivian rules of the Bolivian constitution, in order to avoid a second round in a presidential election, the winning candidate must win by a margin of at least 10%.
Right.
Well, they did, and Evo Morales did. Now, the Organization of American States intervened and said, well, we're not sure that he did, and we don't think he did, so let's do an audit. Right. And we'd like to do an audit. And at the same time as they said that, the right wing synchronized with that and engaged in vicious attacks against indigenous people in general. But they actually made their way to La Paz, the capital, and started attacking the homes and threatening Evo Morales' ministers and their families.
Right.
Right. At the same time as the OS is saying, right, we need an audit. Well, your man, Evo Morales, he agreed to the audit. And the audit was supposed to last 12 days. But completely breaking the agreement, the Organization of American States issued what they called a preliminary report. And in that preliminary report, they complained about irregularities affecting less than 1% of the vote. And even if you... And people like Mark Weisbrot and his team, the team at CEPR, the Council for Economic and Policy Research,
right.
And not just them, also a guy at Michigan University, an electoral specialist who did an analysis, and also a local South American research group called CELAG, they did an analysis, and all of them agree that the so-called irregularities identified by the OAS affect less than 1% of the total number of polling stations, and that statistically that in no way affects the validity of Evo Morales' win. Obviously that doesn't matter, and the facts and the truth and the correct analysis of the statistical data, that doesn't matter from the point of view of the Organization of American States or the people behind them. I mean, what they're interested in is what political effect can we gain by pretending otherwise.
Right, they're seizing power. That's what they're doing is intended to seize power.
Yeah, and they work. It was obviously very clearly organized and synchronized and had been going on for some years. And it's in the same way that in Nicaragua and in Venezuela, the attempts to overthrow the governments there had been long years of preparation.
Yep.
In Nicaragua's case, since at least 2014 or earlier. And the same is true in Bolivia. And there's a extensive documentation of U.S. intervention among all the sectors that took part in the coup over the last 3 weeks or so,
right.
Over the last month now, since October the 20th.
Right.
And one of the aspects that's particularly frustrating and disappointing and irritating for somebody who's anyone who's lived through this kind of experience of a country that's been targeted by the United States and its local allies is the sheer falsity of the coverage in Western media.
Yep.
And in Western media, for example, in Bolivia, they're accusing Evo Morales of provoking the violence
here,
which is absolutely.
Wall Street Journal headline. Here's a Wall Street Journal headline. Morales made Bolivia a narco state.
Oh, yeah, I'm just ridiculous. I know, as if the drugs dealing Drugs Enforcement Administration of the United States that acts to protect the U.S. approved cartels, you know, wasn't that. Why did they get slung out? Why did Venezuela throw out the DEA? Why did Bolivia throw out the DEA?
Right.
Because as the Venezuelan Interior Minister said back then when they threw out the DEA, we identified the DEA as another drugs cartel.
That's right.
They're
the preeminent one. If I try to smuggle drugs into the country, they take them from me, and then they bring it in themselves.
Right. So, it's ridiculous to even consider seriously any comment or analysis from any of the liberal Western media, because right. one of the great lines in Alvaro Garcia Linera's article, right at the end of his article, is, "Behind every mediocre liberal, you will find a consummate coup plotter." And consummate coup plotter is his code for fascist.
Right.
And we've seen it in shifting away from Latin America. And look at the way Western media, from the BBC to CNN to the Guardian in the UK or the New York Times or any of these Western media, they've always sided with the most reactionary forces anywhere. And in the Ukraine, they sided with Nazis. In the Ivory Coast, they sided with the most extreme right-wing group there that was supported by the French armed forces with the blessing of the United Nations. In Libya, they sided with the corrupt right-wing elite that tried to strong-arm Muammar Gaddafi into implementing neoliberal policies, and he refused, and that's why they overthrew him, because they weren't getting a big enough cut of whatever pie there was to divide. And in Libya too, they sided with extremist pseudo-Islamist terrorists, as Muammar Gaddafi correctly stated. Yeah. Right. The same happened in Syria. In Venezuela, all these liberal media are siding with the most extreme right-wing forces in Venezuela, individuals like Juan Guaido and so on. And in Nicaragua too, they've also sided with the extreme right-wing. So it's obvious that the Western media, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or Washington Post or any of them, they're all going to lie through their teeth to try and justify the military coup.
And what gets me when these things happen?
They won't even call it a coup.
They won't even. They're not. It's called an alleged coup. For example, the Wikipedia during times like this. Langley is heavily editing the hell out of these things. And in there, everywhere it says coup, it says alleged coup. and the alleged link, not hot. So there's no reference to why it's only an allegation and not a coup. But what gets me, they ride in on this horse of democracy right after they lose an election to seize power. This is what, what happens a lot. In Honduras, it was over term limits. Term limit. Term limited, they were approved in a referendum, but they were supposedly to defend the country against the unfair advantage that he had in the referendum because he was the president at the time. And Penn, we don't want term limits, and so there was a coup to undo that. This is there are all these different things that sound like democratic devices, but they leave out, for example, that it's the OAS that thinks the term limits are undemocratic. If you look at the actual drafting of legislation that comes out of their model legislation, then and the places that respect that. But, the contradiction is what gets me, that they come in to negate an election in the name of democracy.
I think it's important let's not devote too much time to complaining about how unfair it is. It's obviously unfair.
Right.
The nitty-gritty is that the ordinary people in Bolivia, the majority in Bolivia, they are not going to take it. They're not accepting it.
That's right.
And over the weekend, there was a massacre of, it turned out, and I think it's at least 9 indigenous people who were shot by the army. Some of them were shot by military firing from a helicopter.
Right.
And none of that was reported.
Right.
But there's fierce resistance in Bolivia to the coup. So far, it's been relatively peaceful. But Evo Morales is right to fear that there may be a civil war. And it's difficult to see how the authorities in Bolivia, and we said this last week, they're going to have to make a historic choice between carrying out a massacre in order to make their coup work or not. And if they don't, then they're going to have to accept that they lost their coup.
It's a real scary scenario is being set up, and hopefully cooler heads will prevail, but there's not really a long history of that happening. So we'll just keep an eye on it, and we'll be back next week. Tony, thank you very much, as always.
Thanks,
Don. Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.